Welcome to The B-Word, a podcast about humans, organisations, behaviour. I'm your host, James Healy. We're going to start this episode with a confession. We can see your data. What I mean by that is that every time you download an episode of this podcast, our publishing software records that fact, and it appears in a dashboard for our team to view. Now, I don't want you to worry. We can't see anything too personal about you, but we can see which country and state you're in, which episode you listen to, and which platform you use to download it. This gives us some useful and sometimes surprising insights. Kenya is our third biggest country for listeners. Episodes about HR are more popular than those about genocide, and more of our listeners use Apple than Spotify. But the point is this. I bet you didn't realize you were leaving a data trail for us. You probably just clicked download and didn't think about it. It's something we all do countless times every day, at work or on our personal devices. Click, click, click. And every click creates data. Data that someone else can see. Data that someone else can use. Now, rest assured, we're not monetizing your data and we're not weaponizing it against you. But make no mistake, others might be. Should we be concerned about how our personal data is used? Do the benefits of personalization outweigh the drawbacks? And are there opportunities for organizations to use our data to improve our working lives, as well as increase sales? Today's guest is an expert on this topic. Patrick Fagan is a lecturer, author, and public speaker, and consults for brands and political campaigns around the world. His expertise lies in understanding audiences' minds, optimizing clients' communications, and nudging people's behaviors. Patrick was lead psychologist at Cambridge Analytica until the company went into administration. He lectures part-time at multiple London universities, teaching modules on consumer behavior, social cognition, and the psychology of marketing and advertising. Patrick has co-authored peer-reviewed papers on topics ranging from facial expressions to Facebook. His book on the psychology of effective communication, Hooked, Why Cute Sells and Other Marketing Magic That We Just Can't Resist, was published in 2016. Patrick, welcome. Good morning.
Hi, thank you. Good to be here.
So, Patrick, let's start by talking about Cambridge Analytica. Two words that I think everyone has heard.
Yeah.
Talk to us a little bit about your experience. What was your role there? What did you do?
Sure. So I was the lead psychologist there for the last 8 months of the company, which is a very interesting experience, to say the least. And I suppose I should caveat that by saying there were two departments. There was a commercial department and a political department. So I didn't have much involvement with the political department, just to be clear on that. So I was more about doing targeted advertising for bottled water, which has ethical issues in itself, but bottled water and insurance and things like that. So what I did there was help to develop psychometric tests, personality tests, but measuring other things, motivations, behaviors, etc., and send them to people in order to kind of profile the different segments. But then the really key bit was also the so what from that. So how do we actually use this personality insight to design messaging that's going to resonate with the different customer groups?
Interesting. So on the topic of personality testing and how that can be, I guess, how personality data can be used to target messaging, I think I recall a statistic about Facebook and about the number of Facebook data points that enable an algorithm to predict your personality. Mm-hmm. What was that? And do you want to share with our listeners the quite horrifying conclusions of that?
Yeah, there was a peer-reviewed paper where there was famously some academics who created an algorithm that could predict your personality from Facebook likes. They created this My Personality quiz that people took on Facebook. The quiz also scraped your data from your profile, and it could link the two. And so the algorithm that they developed was better able to predict your personality or your self-reported personality if it had the average number of Facebook likes at the time, which is about 230, something like that. It could predict your personality better than could someone you live with, someone you work with, a friend or roommate. It could predict your personality better than them. The only person who knows you better is your spouse. But of course, if the algorithm has more likes from you, about 300 or so more likes, it can predict your personality even better than your spouse can on average.
So 300 Facebook likes is enough to understand my personality better than my wife?
Yeah, on average. I mean, obviously, you know, with individuals, there's lots of nuance and complexity, but yes.
So I'm slightly speechless with that number. I should stress, by the way, that I'm not actually on Facebook and never have been. So I feel extra virtuous and safe, although I suspect there might be other means of acquiring my data, which we'll come on to. What are the implications of this? And I guess, what are the use cases? How is this kind of data and this kind of personality assessment used?
Well, it's used really to customize messaging and nudges, behavioral campaigns, really, because what works for one audience might not necessarily work for a different audience, or likewise for a particular brand or product or category. For example, very obvious example, if you're selling baked beans, scarcity doesn't really work as a nudge because nobody really wants limited edition beans. Whereas on the other hand, if you're selling luxury handbags, social proof doesn't really work. In fact, it can be counterproductive because nobody wants a luxury item that everyone has. So it depends on context. And there was a study that found that having a picture of a smiling, attractive woman on a letter increased loan uptake, but only among men. So the whole point being that different nudges, different messaging works for different people. So what you can do with psychometrics is understand what is the psychology of the different groups that you're talking to, or, you know, just profiling your customer base or your target group in general. You don't have to get into specific segments, but maybe just the people who work in a particular office, you might want to find out what their personality is compared to the average so that you can design interventions that will work well for them. And there are lots of others. You know, it doesn't have to be nudging. You can use it obviously for recruitment to find people who are best for a role. For example, if you want to find happy people for service jobs, then you can build a test to measure happiness. You can use it to predict outcomes. For example, if people default on a loan, sensation seeking is a really good predictor of that. So if you're an insurer or a lender or some kind of financial services company, you might want to have a very brief measure of sensation seeking in the sign-up process, or measure it indirectly. So that's also where psychometrics are very useful, is in building models where you can measure personality and traits through passive data collection. So you can see how often someone logs into the app, what time of day and what day of the week they log in, how long they stay there, what they look at, et cetera. You can build a model on top of that data. So if you are a pet store, you might, through using psychometrics, you might find out that people who shop for tarantula products on 3 a.m. on a Friday or Saturday, they're very high in sensation seeking. So next time people are browsing for tarantula products late at night, you know what messaging to send them.
I love the image of 3 a.m. on a Saturday online shopping for a tarantula. I won't dwell too long on that. I guess, question for you, for those of us who don't work in advertising or marketing, how widespread are these techniques? Is this something that is, you know, done by relatively specialist organizations like Cambridge Analytica and its successors, or is this something that is fairly widespread?
Well, in a way, everyone does it. I mean, even I'm doing it right now in this conversation. I'm kind of customizing what I say and how I say it to hopefully have a persuasive effect. And how the things I say and the way I say them might be different on this podcast to another podcast. So we all kind of customize our language and our persuasive techniques depending on the context. But to your point, I mean, who's doing this at a kind of industrial level, commercially? Well, it depends. I mean, from a behavioral science point of view, lots of people are doing it. More and more people are doing it. All sorts of companies, for example, have started to hire their own behavioral scientists, if not consult with agencies. There's a growing recognition of how powerful it can be. But for the targeted side of things, this is relatively new. And even companies that you think would be very sophisticated, actually, in my experience, are not as sophisticated as you might think they are at this kind of targeted persuasion. And lots of companies, again, even big companies, they don't really have the data capabilities and know-how a lot of the time to get it perfectly right. So there's a huge amount of opportunity and enthusiasm, but we're still trying to kind of catch up to that a lot of the time.
Interesting. So I guess, yeah, my perception and the popular perception from shows like The Social Dilemma is that this is fairly prevalent now, and that all of our data is being monetized and to some extent weaponized against us. It sounds like you're saying that's maybe less true than we might fear. Is that fair?
I think it depends. I mean, big tech is a very different beast to, say, I don't know, Sainsbury's or something. Your data is definitely being collected. It's definitely being used against you. Might be a bit harsh, but it's definitely being used for their benefit to kind of influence your behavior. But I don't think the scale and the sophistication of it is. I think there's a bit of illusion, I suppose, a bit like the Wizard of Oz, that people see it as more powerful than it is. I've heard Cambridge Analytica be described as MK Ultra stuff, like brainwashing, mind control. It really was just a digital advertising agency that used personality traits. It works, generally speaking, not always, but it works. There's some good evidence, academic peer-reviewed evidence that it works. Obviously, I have case studies that it works. But I don't think it's this like mind-bending, society-controlling tool just yet, but I think it probably will be quite soon.
So that raises some ethical questions, and we will come back to the ethical questions, but you actually triggered a thought. I think you mentioned Sainsbury's and why I think about retailers. There's a great story in your book, and some of our listeners may have heard it, but it's about Walmart in the US and a particularly infamous case of Walmart's data providing some information about a customer that led to some interesting consequences. Do you want to talk about that one?
Yeah. Oh, I think it was Target, which is ironic considering what it was. But so there was a young woman, a young girl, a teenager, I think, and her father was quite angry with Target, I think, because they were sending her promotions to do with pregnancy. And he was like, well, you're encouraging my daughter to get pregnant. That's not great. But actually what had happened was Target had predicted that she was pregnant through her purchases. So she bought certain cosmetics or vitamins or supplements in a certain pattern over time. And from their predictive analytics, they could guess that she was probably pregnant and she was this far along. So they were able to predict that before her own father knew. And as you said, yeah, this is, I think, 10 or 15 years ago, this case study.
How could I forget it was Target? That's fairly key to the punchline. And I probably slandered Walmart there, so apologies. I think it's a really, really powerful example that essentially your data and your online footprint, you know, it reinforces that point about Facebook likes predicting your personality. That data footprint that we all leave really does enable very powerful insights around our lifestyle and around our personality. And I think there's obviously a very well reported trend for retailers and marketers to use these techniques. As regular listeners of the podcast will have heard me say before, one of the things that fascinates me is this kind of paradox and this kind of contrast between retail marketing and then HR departments within organizations. So essentially, you have this conjunction of data science and behavioral science being used to create very sophisticated, targeted interventions to nudge behavior, specifically consumer behavior, specifically buying behavior. But many of the same organizations, their HR departments and others trying to influence behavior within the organization are not using any of these techniques at all.
Yeah.
Do you have a perspective on this and any opportunities or anyone that might be doing this particularly well?
Well, I certainly have a perspective that I agree with you, and I've seen it, for example, in computer security as well, is quite blunt tools that are being used, just, for example, posters in offices and blanket email campaigns, maybe an hour workshop that's very dry and not particularly engaging. So I think, again, there's a huge opportunity here to use, to use behavioral science and marketing techniques in general, just to make these things more effective, more engaging, more persuasive, but also, yes, to do it on a targeted basis. You could potentially see if people are burned out. You can predict that from certain data points, or are they enjoying their job or not? Should they be given some kind of bonus or pay rise to keep them happy? What are the nudges that will work best to make them most efficient and productive throughout the day? All of this stuff will differ between people based on their personality, where they are at that particular moment in time in their life and in their job. And it's all measurable through passive cues. I mean, you could measure keystrokes. I don't know what the privacy implications would be, but if you could, and you can see even how fast people are typing, but also, of course, the words that they're using, you can predict their mood, their personality, etc., and target interventions to them. Exactly the same principle can be applied internally and to recruitment as well.
Yeah, so I think this has come to the fore a little bit over the last couple of years with the pandemic and with the move to remote working. And you tend to read lots of, I think, fairly sensationalized stories about employers applying, for want of a better word, spyware to track what their employees are up to. Mm-hmm. And it does tend to raise lots of privacy concerns.
Yeah, I definitely wouldn't recommend it. Number one, it's not very ethical, but number two, people tend to, I think, do better when they have autonomy and they feel that they have more kind of freedom and control. I think is actually better for productivity in the long run.
Yeah, so that was going to be my question. I will come back to the ethics. I keep saying that, but I definitely will. But I was going to ask, is there a limit to the effectiveness of these kinds of interventions and this kind of data? And at what point does, I guess, awareness of these techniques lead to reactance and a sort of pushback?
Well, there's certainly limitations from a kind of methodological point of view. There can be lots of noise in the data. Sometimes you're building models on top of models. Sometimes the systems aren't in place to distribute the targeted interventions, or the systems aren't in place to actually measure the outcome and see if they worked or not. So there are issues from that point of view. From a recipient point of view, yes, there is reactance. People generally don't like being told what to do. There was, I saw a paper, it was quite amusing. I don't know if you remember the Uber ad campaign under the pandemic, where they said no mask, no ride. And this paper found that actually that made people dislike the brand and actually made them less likely to wear a mask, because they didn't like being told what to do in a kind of threatening, forceful way. But generally speaking, yes, people show reactance. There is, interestingly, some research that if you tell people you're nudging them, if you're transparent about it, it doesn't diminish the power of the nudge, because it's like an optical illusion. You can't unsee it. Even if you know it's there, it still affects you. But then it also kind of mitigates reactance. So I think there was a paper that showed that actually, if you're transparent, it can actually make them more effective, because then people are like, oh, I'm in control. I wouldn't get nudged. And then that makes them more susceptible to be nudged. So I think it's good on all sides to be transparent. But as you say, there is a bit of an arms race between the people making the messages and people sending them. And not unreasonably, people are getting a bit more cynical maybe and, I don't know, aware of these things.
So to build on that, something that I've observed, and I've had some conversations with clients sort of along these lines fairly recently, there is this paradox that many of us, I won't say all of us, but many of us are fairly blasé about the data that we put into our various devices and the data footprint that we leave behind us. And we're fairly blasé about the use of that data, you know, for advertising, marketing, essentially trying to push us to buy things online. But as soon as we start to talk about employers harvesting data that we are, to be clear, putting into employers' systems, people get a lot more wary. I'm interested in any perspectives on that and why you think that might be.
That's interesting. Well, I suppose with an employer, there's a power differential. You know, with Coca-Cola, they didn't really have any impact or control over my life. I'm not reliant on them for my income, or they don't tell me to be here at this certain time or this day. Whereas with your employer, they have all this power over you. So for them to start, to start taking data really is to really increase that power even more. And yeah, people don't like powerlessness. And that's where a lot of anger and resentment tends to come from, really, is feeling powerless. And there's probably maybe a fairness aspect to it as well, because we don't like unfairness. So maybe that's why. Maybe also people are in different states of mind when you're at work. Maybe you're in more of a functional, effortful thinking state of mind a little bit, maybe. You treat it more functionally. You treat it more as a transactional relationship, whereas when you're using technology or you're engaging with brands, maybe it's more emotional and passive. I don't know, I'm just brainstorming here. That's a really interesting question.
No, it really is. And I think it does to some extent link to the next question that I'm going to ask, which does take us back to Cambridge Analytica, and I appreciate not your part of that business. Without getting into politics here and without defending the particular individual that we'll talk about in a moment, I always found it fascinating that following the 2008 and 2012 US elections, there was this huge storm of positive publicity about the Obama campaigns and their use of data, their use of behavioral science. There's even a book, if anyone's interested, The Victory Lab by Sasha Isenberg, which is 300 pages about how the Obama campaign used data, used behavioral science. And yet in 2016, Obama's successor and his campaign used what seemed to me at least to be ostensibly the same techniques and received a rather different reception. Why do you think that was?
Well, people didn't like him. I mean, especially the press, the kind of quote unquote chattering classes in the media and so on tend to lean more left wing. And I'm not, these days I'm fairly apolitical, and I see all politicians basically the same, to be honest. Trump wasn't seen in particularly good light. People didn't like that he had won. And that produced a kind of cognitive dissonance where people were looking for explanations as to why he could have won, because the idea that people would like him and vote for him of their own volition was kind of, so many people, not majority, but in a Republican sense, majority, I suppose, majority of states voted for him. So why would that be? So people kind of, I think, to be honest, grasping at straws, looking for explanations, Russian bot farms, WikiLeaks emails, and Cambridge Analytica was another one of those things. I'm not saying the company didn't do anything wrong, but absolutely, I mean, in terms of the psychometric techniques they were using and the data analysis, the targeted messaging, brands were doing that, continue to do that, political campaigns as well. The Hillary Clinton campaign did it. There was an Atlantic article after she lost, saying her campaign was too smart to win. They'd use data analytics too well to win the campaign. It's just purely politics, really. It was a good scapegoat. It's a useful political scapegoat for people.
And I think there's an interesting follow-on to that, which is around, and this does really take us into the ethics, is it the techniques or is it how the techniques are applied or why the techniques are applied? What do you think drives the ethical question here and how you answer that ethical question?
This is something I've thought about a lot, as you can probably imagine. Obviously the intention is a big part of it. You know, you probably shouldn't use it to get people to smoke crack, for example, is probably not good, or selling weapons, that kind of thing. Although then, you know, what about guns manufacturers in the US? Is that ethical or not? Again, it kind of depends on your view, I suppose. But for me, I've kind of boiled it down to three things, which are potentially quite different. Again, they represent my own bias and my own kind of prejudices and preferences. But I boiled it down to three things for me personally. One is empathy. So not using anything that's going to hurt people, particularly from the nudges point of view, not hurting people emotionally, psychologically. So not using things like fear or guilt or shame or anything like that. The second one is respect. So giving people a choice to kind of to have their say, being transparent, and respecting if they are not nudged by it and they don't like your message and they reject it, that's the end of that. So I think it's important to respect people. And then the third thing is humility, which is all about the fact that we are all irrational. All of us, even the people designing interventions, the behavioral scientists are irrational as well. All of us are. And so to paraphrase Aldous Huxley, it's about just bearing in mind who nudges the nudges and not thinking that you are more rational than your target audience. There's a fascinating paper on how conspiracy theories actually are psychologically useful to people. That they keep them kind of in a state of mental wellness in a way, by explaining, giving some kind of structure to the world, a sense of power, I suppose, and a sense of kind of safety and certainty about the world. So kind of nudging people out of that because you think it's the best thing to do because you don't agree with it, is potentially not great. So just, yeah, bear in mind that you are probably not more rational and just have some, sorry, you're not more rational than your target audience. Just have some humility. And related to that is just be aware of unintended consequences. So there was a paper where they used the watching eyes effect, where people act more pro-socially if they feel like they're being watched. So I might be getting the details wrong, but I think they put a picture of a pair of eyes up at a train station where the bicycles were to prevent bicycle theft. And it did prevent bicycle theft, but bicycle thefts at the next train station where there weren't any pictures of eyes went up an equivalent amount. So there can be unintended consequences. So it's just kind of tread lightly, be careful. So for me, those are really key. And I suppose from a data point of view, there's some elements there as well. Be transparent, don't be creepy. Just be very clear about what you're doing. Let people opt out if they want to. But that, again, is all about autonomy, which we talked about before. Just don't take away people's ultimate choice to do what they want with their data or with your brand and so on.
So there's a lot there, and I do want to unpick some of that. But I was particularly struck by your example around conspiracy theories. And I think this links back very nicely to your answer to the question around Trump and why people reacted differently to the 2016 election versus 2008 or 2012. And I think I find conspiracy theories absolutely fascinating, but there is this element to which they do provide comfort and they do provide an overarching explanation. I've personally spent a bit of time in the Middle East in the past, kind of really before the Arab Spring, And in a number of countries there, which have had very turbulent histories, you talk to people and they have this absolute faith in what are, to my mind at least, wild conspiracy theories. And the average person in most Arab countries believes that Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, is controlling everything from the most sort of big picture geopolitics through to very trivial things like how much things cost in supermarkets. And on one level, it's a little bit sad, but it's also, I think, a part of what it is to be human. We are desperately looking for explanations. We are desperately looking to understand the world around us. And we are suckers for a story. And conspiracy theories are really compelling stories.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would say as well, I mean, powerful groups do conspire to do things. You know, not the Mossad necessarily, but powerful people do get together and they make plans for the future, and they want to bring certain outcomes around. So that's number one thing, is that, you know, these aren't always totally kind of irrational and wrong. But yes, so there's a great book called The Denial of Death, which is all about the fact that we're dying. All of us are dying. We'll die one day. We're just decaying meat puppets. And that's a very traumatic thing to realize. So we try not to realize it. We try not to think about it as much as possible. Not just that we're dying, but related to that the world is chaotic and scary place. So we look for structure, and we look for structure and safety and certainty. And some people do this through, say, drink or drugs or gambling, because it distracts them from the chaos and scary nature of the world. Whereas other people look for structure in things like religion. I'm not disparaging religion, but I'm just saying it's something that gives you a perspective on the world. Everything's very sure. It gives you kind of rules to live by. This is why I think Jordan Peterson, he wrote a book which is basically, what was it, 12 Rules for Life or something. Like, people are clamoring for this kind of certainty and security. And the universe is infinitely complex, and our brains are very, very tiny relative to all of this information that's out there. So we are really kind of awash in a sea of chaos, and we need structure in order to function. And talking about conspiracy theorists, you know, some people believe that the Earth is flat. I'm not one of them, but I think it's a useful thought exercise, which is, how do we know it's not? And we only know it's not, the vast majority of us, because we've been told this by people in white lab coats, or people in white lab coats have shown us pictures, but they could be composites, it could be CGI, I don't know. We've said there are experiments you can do with pendulums which prove that the Earth is rotating, but I've never done them. I'm assuming you haven't. Neither of us has been to space and seen the Earth, I would assume. So we're taking a lot of this as for granted from people who we trust to know what we're talking about. So we also have this kind of structural perception of reality. We have our own blinders on. I'm not saying they're wrong, but we all do it. We all have to. We just don't have the brain power to think things through carefully, rationally.
I think that's a really profound point. And I vividly remember, and I will always remember, a conversation I had in Damascus in Syria with a local Syrian guy who was my language partner. I was helping him practice conversational English. He was helping me practice conversational Arabic. And we had this conversation one day about September the 11th. And he had subscribed to the view, which is fairly common in that part of the world, that September the 11th was an elaborate kind of CIA hoax, which, spoiler alert, is not my personal perspective on that event. But I remember having this conversation with him and this moment of dawning realization that he absolutely believed his point of view in exactly the same way that I believed mine. And he thought mine was as ridiculous as I thought his was. And he thought I was as deluded as I thought he was. Mm-hmm. And it didn't change my view of that particular event, just to be clear. But it was this really thought-provoking moment about, how do we know anything?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, I mean, 9/11, I'd be lying if I said I didn't have questions. But yeah, I'm not here to talk about that. But I think, yeah, it's very humbling, you know, to with 9/11, I just kind of, I'm at the point where I'm like, there are things I don't know. And I think there's a personality trait called need for cognitive closure. Some people just need things to be binary, black and white, split thinking. It's either this or that, you're either right or you're wrong. And obviously that's true, and that exists in nature to an extent, this binary. But I think it's important to be comfortable in that space of not knowing and realizing there are other perspectives out there. And a lot, I was talking to a semiotician actually, because I'm researching a new book, and she was saying about how a lot of pain, psychological, emotional pain, comes from being stuck in a particular reality and being attached to certain ideas and things. And actually, if you can kind of be more humble and look at other people's perspectives, that can kind of bring you out of your reality, and it can be quite of a revitalizing thing, quite good for you.
I find that fascinating, and I could quite easily take us down a rabbit hole here to talk about conspiracy theories and the nature of knowledge and belief. I won't do that in the interest of our listeners. I am keen to get a perspective from you on where you see behavioral science, data science, behavioral data science going in the future. So we've talked a lot about where it is and where it has come from. Where do you see this discipline, these techniques, going in the next 5, 10, 15 years?
Well, they will likely become more sophisticated. The algorithms will become better. There'll be more and more data collected on us at all kind of points, and the models built on that data will become better and more useful for us as users, I suppose. You know, you can have personalized recommendations that you actually want, and then that kind of stops being advertising or nudging and starts being just useful stuff that you want. It's just information. That I suppose that's a nice way of looking at it. So more data, more touch points to do nudges, you know, as we're using apps and everything. There are just more chances to interact with people, and then more chances to, and therefore more chances to try out these nudges and to collect the data and see if they actually work. And potentially biometrics could come into play. I mean, this is maybe a bit further down the line, but things like Neuralink, you know, in theory, that's going to give brands or governments or whomever the ability to read and change your mind directly at the source, which is a bit of a frightening prospect. But for now, I think, yeah, just more data, better use of it, more touch points, chances to test and to optimize and iterate. And also, we've talked about personality and how that can be used for targeted nudges, but I think we're going to see more what are called going from traits to states. So we'll look at more momentary stuff, how people are feeling in a particular moment, what their goals are, you know, the advert somebody receives just after their pet has died is going to be quite different to other times. You know, it doesn't matter if it's targeted to you as an extrovert. If your cat has just died, you're going to be sad. And so an extroverted advert worked. So I think we'll see more of that kind of momentary state and mood-based targeting.
I think that's really interesting. A final question then, where do you see this going for organizations? So we've talked a lot about consumers, nudging buying behavior, nudging voting behavior. Where do you see the big opportunities for organizations to use these techniques internally on their own employees?
To better understand your employees, of course. So again, the personality, but also momentary things. How are they feeling that day, that week? How are they getting on in their job? And to send messages to them accordingly. So you can consider it like empathy at scale. So you can be empathetic with large numbers of employees potentially with this technology. And just matching people to the right jobs also matching team members together will be interesting to watch, because you might think that you want to have, you know, successful people tend to be more disagreeable. They tend to be more competitive and non-cooperative. maybe more extroverted, but to have a whole team of that would probably be a nightmare, you know, to have a whole bunch of competitive people arguing with one another. So the team dynamics will be quite interesting to see how that kind of stuff plays out.
My mind is going wild now with that and how that might be useful. I guess to wrap this up then, there's a great quote that I've heard you use before that I think comes from Jurassic Park, but which really sums up the ethics or the ethical questions around behavioral science and around data science. What is that quote, and what on earth do big scary dinosaurs have to do with marketing and behavior change?
Well, it's Jurassic Park is actually one of my favorite films. Obviously, it terrified me as a kid, but it has some nice kind of philosophical messages in there. I mean, yeah, it is a kid's dinosaur film, but it has some nice messages in there. One of which, of course, is life finds a way. And that, again, takes us back to the humility point before. When you're dealing with people, you're dealing with these huge, very complex systems that all have their own interests and goals and so on. And they can, generally speaking, work things out among themselves. So that's one thing. But then, as you said, or referred to, your scientists were too preoccupied with whether they could do something to think about whether they should do it. Now, with data science, behavioral science, etc., the cat's out of the bag. You can't send technology backwards. You can't uninvent technology. So it's here. So the question then becomes, well, you probably should use it, otherwise you'll get left behind as a business. So then how do you do it ethically? And that's where, as I said before, I think autonomy is really, really key. Not doing things to manipulate people subconsciously as much as that's possible, being transparent, giving people the opt-out option, and being fair and just being totally upfront about what you're doing and your intentions.
That's great. And I think that's a great place to finish the conversation. Lots and lots to ponder. I certainly found it very thought-provoking. Thank you, Patrick. Really, really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
If you remember nothing else from that conversation, I suspect it'll be the study about Facebook. 300 data points from Facebook is enough to predict your personality more accurately than your spouse. Wow. If you're a Facebook user, and I have to say at this point, I'm more relieved than ever that I'm not. But if you are, just think about how long it takes you to produce those 300 data points. A week? A day? A couple of hours? Imagine how many data points that platform has got on you in the 2 decades it's been in existence. Or perhaps your key takeaway is the story about the unfortunate gentleman finding out from Target that his teenage daughter was pregnant. It's a truly Orwellian state of affairs when your local discount retailer knows more about your children than you do. These are the shocking headlines from my conversation with Patrick. And combined with the mention of everyone's favorite data bogeyman, Cambridge Analytica, it'd be very easy to draw some obvious and disturbing conclusions about the perils of our data being used against us by shadowy forces cunningly manipulating our behavior. But that's not actually the way that I see it. The key point for me is that the genie's out of the bottle and it's not going back in. For me, it's not so much about the techniques themselves, as about what they're used for. The contrast between Obama and Trump is an instructive one. Their campaigns used basically the same techniques, but our response says far more about whether we like Obama or Trump than the techniques themselves. For me, there's a huge opportunity here. We need to have a conversation about how we can use these tools for good. How do we combine data science and behavioral science for something other than selling us more stuff or pushing ever more extreme political perspectives on us? And much of that opportunity is about organizations turning inwards and using these tools for employees, not just consumers. How do we use behavioral data to make hybrid working work, to improve our health and well-being, to make our workplaces more human. How do we use behavioral data to improve diversity and inclusion, encourage sustainability, or enhance cybersecurity? How do we use our data trail to nudge ourselves for good?